I'm Michael Silverblatt. Before we start this episode of Bookworm, I'd like to invite you to become a part of something very exciting that's happening at KCRW. Right now, it's our summer fund drive, and we are doing things differently this time around. We've shortened our fundraising period so we can bring you more of the programming you rely on every day. But we still need to raise the funds to keep the station going. In fact, we have to raise the same amount of money in 9 days that we usually raise in 11. So if you enjoy this weekly podcast of Bookworm, where we explore the imaginative process of storytelling through in-depth interviews with groundbreaking writers, become a KCRW member today. Help us keep our pledge drive short. Join as a star member for just $5 or $10 a month, or a star angel for just $32 a month, and join the Bookworm Book Club. Donating is easy and only takes a moment. Call 800-600-KCRW or join at kcrw.com. You could win a fantastic trip to Hong Kong or drive off in a new Subaru Outback. And thanks. Now on to Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest Martha McPhee. Her newest book is Dear Money, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. In the course of the novel, its heroine, India Palmer, a critically acclaimed novelist struggling to make ends meet, is transformed into a wildly successful and rich bond trader. Now, India has a remarkable experience. Out of the blue, as the book likes to say, onto a beach arrives a yellow biplane, and in that biplane is a mortgage bonds trader who says, I bet that I could make you a top mortgage bond salesperson, trader, within 18 months. And our India has had enough. I mean, it doesn't seem fair to her anymore. And what's more, she's gone through a whole period of her life practically living like Madame Bovary, robbing Peter to pay Paul, looking for money, owing, telling lies. She's willing to do anything, and she's willing to surrender. She's just enough art.
Well, I had a lot of fun with that. You know, I really did want to write a book that would be fun for me to engage with. And I actually did meet a bond trader at a garden party. And I knew he was a banker of some sort. And so I started talking to him, and he told me all about what he did. He was a trader of mortgage-backed securities. And he explained what they were, pools of our puny debts for our mortgages bundled and packaged and shipped off to China, et cetera. And I found it fascinating. And I asked him a lot of questions, and he said, you know, it's not that hard to do. Anybody can do it. We're just used car salesmen. You could do it. You give me 18 months, I'll turn you into a trader. And I knew right there that was my next novel. It was 2004, so it was, you know, before this big crisis had really blown, the balloon had gotten as full as it got before it burst. And, you know, it seemed like an interesting premise to me to explore that path. What, you know, what if the artist did do that?
Well, many artists have, despite anything, everything, a moral sense that prevents them from going whole hog.
Well, she grapples with that throughout the novel, and she feels like she's betraying not her. It's this, I am having fun with, you know, this sort of seduction of the bond trader with India. Is it, you know, a sexual, romantic thing, or is it money in the end? And obviously, in the end, it's money. But she definitely, you know, that was definitely something I wanted to play with. Also, the market was exploding in front of me. By the time I started writing, the second half was, I'd say late 2006, early 2007. Early February 2007, I earnestly collected magazine and newspaper articles that were about the mortgage-backed securities market to read up. Starting in 2004, I had one little notebook. 2007, February, they started climbing up to the ceiling. By June, the hedge funds at Bear Stearns had collapsed. And my husband said, you got to throw those magazines out where they're going to collect bugs because they were so high. And so learning all of that stuff and you know, landing on a topic that ended up being, you know, the, you know, sort of the story of the first part of this, you know, century was, you know, mind-bogglingly difficult.
Yeah, every writer prays for it, but then I had imagined you couldn't write fast enough out of fear that the story would escape you.
Yes, and then I got to the end and I stopped writing for 4 months. I couldn't think about what the end would be because I hadn't intended to write a book about the collapse of Wall Street. Lehman Brothers was blowing up and everything went down. You probably remember how crazy that was. We thought we were heading toward the next depression. And so I couldn't write. But then what I remembered after 4 months of, you know, not doing anything was that I had not set out to write about, you know, Wall Street and the collapse. I had set out to write, you know, about the culture that I was seeing and what it was like to be on the street as a writer down in, you know, down on Main Street. And returning to that allowed me to finish it.
Now, you've written a very wicked novel, and I hope you'll pay for it because...
Pay for it? In what way?
Well, wouldn't it be marvelous if it woke up the whole community of artists and publishers and instead they were to turn against you? How dare you write this immoral novel in which an artist gives up the credo of art?
If they would pay attention, I would be so thrilled. But, you know... But what I have heard and noticed, is that there's a character in the novel who's a banker who becomes a novelist. So there's this trading place trope that I'm also playing with. People have said he was so brave and, you know, to do such a risky thing, whereas I get more that she is greedy because she goes, you know, to Wall Street and gives up on the art. So we do hold the artist to a higher standard.
Yes, we always are reading now about these people in banks and on Wall Street who have been yearning their whole lives to put it all behind them, move to the country and write their novels. And, you know, to some extent, a novel isn't written because it wants to be written. Mm-hmm. You know, a novel is written by someone who's learned how to write a novel. And, you know, if it is true that 18 months could turn someone into a traitor, do you think it is? I mean, in the book, it seems easy, and I was tempted.
Well, I did a lot of research, and, you know, I really learned what I was talking about. And I had a lot of help from good people on Wall Street who are mortgage-backed securities traders. I have heard that, you know, that they did that was done in the 80s, that they'd like some baseball player and they'd turn him into a trader. But I don't think it would have been for me. But I wouldn't challenge that bet that he made because maybe he could do it. But I don't think it would have been with me.
You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. I'm talking to Martha McPhee. We're talking about Dear Money, a novel that takes place during the incredible boom when suddenly it was thought that mortgages, even by people who couldn't pay them, stacked together and sold, were a good investment. And traders were suddenly able to own a loft in the city, a place in the country, the best car, have an education for their children.
Children. And four or five of their children.
And there's a novelist who's published 4 award-winning books thinking, I would like all that. What if I could be Cinderella? What if this biplane descending trader could give me a life? And what if it is fun to spend money? And what is racy and exciting in this book is that it turns out that it is. This is not a book in which a moral comeuppance is paid. Now, wasn't that tempting too? Don't you always want to see the person who suddenly sells out?
I'll tell you a story.
Yes, please.
I always knew what I wanted to have happen at the end of this book. And when I got there, I had a lot of trepidation. Oh, I can't believe I'm actually doing that. I'm not punishing anybody. And so I started to try to punish her, and I gave it to my father to read.
Yes, your father is the essayist, John McPhee.
And he said, that's wrong. You've got to go back and fix that. No moralizing here. He really helped me. I had the first draft with no moralizing and then added the moralizing. And then he helped. He liberated me. He said, take that out. It was very easy. It took me half an hour. I took it all out. And it was right. It's too easy to punish and moralize. And I think my ideas are pretty clearly there if you're a subtle reader.
And we watch this character undergo a transformation from guilt to an arrogance so impressive that she's able to buy her best friend's dream house out from under her. Not only buy it, what's her first act?
She wants to rip it down.
And replace it with something better. I mean, this is a book sly. Because, you know, of course we can't admire this stuff, and yet this is what the culture has set.
It's all around us.
Yes, it's everywhere. What we're supposed to admire.
And, it's pervasive. It's everywhere. You see, you go to the Hamptons, and you'll see historic houses being ripped down all over the place, and some new architect and some justification, and this one's greener and works better, and that was too old. That's throughout the culture. And the obsession with money, obviously, is too.
In fact, one of the things that's hilarious about this book is that India keeps discovering about the stockbrokers she meets, that they read books.
That was fun for me. Uh-huh. That was very fun for me.
Is that your experience? Do you think the man who offered you this transformation was picking up classic novels to read at the end of the night?
Well, I don't know about him, but actually the person that really did help me the most with this, the real-life person, is an enormous reader. And I do know quite a few bankers from living in New York City, and they do read. And I did have a naive view that they didn't, and they do read. About those bond traders at Goldman Sachs, I don't know, but
what do they read?
Well, you know, there's a big difference between a bond trader and an investment banker. And the investment bankers seem to read more high literary stuff.
Is this how we distinguish them?
Maybe. But my bond trader was a voracious reader of all sorts of stuff.
Now, then,
my real-life bond trader, not my novel bond trader.
Yes, the person who helped you write this book and mm-hmm. gave you insider information
right.
about hamburger eating contests and the way, ultimately, that the floor is like a locker room.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a hilarious book.
I'm so glad you say that.
How then, if they are readers, how do we manage to be angry at them? For I've always been as naive as you claim to have been, and feeling that the culture, what I thought of as my culture, had been destroyed by all this.
Well, I don't think we can make a big blanket statement that they're all readers. I think that might be going too far, or that they're not. But I think it's angry. It's easy to be angry at the bankers because they've gotten us into such a huge mess. But I might go a little further to say we're all cogs in this wheel that's making this, that made this mess. And we all have a certain amount of responsibility.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm talking with Martha McPhee, author most recently of Dear Money. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Martha McPhee about her novel, Dear Money. It's the story of a respected but cash-strapped novelist who, with the help of a Wall Street tycoon, leaves her art behind to become a successful and rich bond trader. Martha McPhee comes from a family of writers. Her sisters write. Her father writes. She announced when her last novel came out that she was writing a novel about money and that it would have a sense of humor. And it's a, it's a serious novel with a sense of humor in that it's a book that will tell you why a writer goes on and why a writer doesn't go on in the face of a culture that values money above all other things, money, property. And this book, Dear Money, is about a woman whose name is India Palmer. And she has written novels which have been respected, given awards, well-reviewed. And she is still borrowing money from month to month to put her children through school, to pay the rent, to work with as a helpmate to her husband in an old-fashioned relationship where two artists meet and marry, and the greater ditherer gets to pay no attention to the books while the person whose head is out of the ground.
That is sounding a little too familiar.
Now, yes, tell me, how familiar is Dear Money to you?
Well, it's both very familiar and it became very new to me, especially once she becomes a bond trader. But the first half of the book is I see the book is shaped, structured as an hourglass, and the first half of the book is about her sort of descent as a novelist, and of course that's territory I know very well, what it's like to be a novelist. But I see India as I see myself in all the characters. And there are parts of India that are me, and there are parts where I had to imagine. But I also see her predicament in a lot of people, her desires, her need, you know, to pay basic expenses, but also her desire to partake of the dessert tray, if you will, as something that a lot of people feel.
Now, this subject is really a dire subject for you and for many writers, but particularly for you because you come from a family of writers and you've been, when not an active artist, you've watched while the New Yorker said no more long pieces to your father, one of the most respected writer of long pieces, long essays in the country, John McPhee. We've watched while publishers have been saying to writers, well, the awards are nice, but if the book doesn't sell at least, what is it now, 15,000 copies, we can't afford to publish it anymore. And most of the so-called mid-list prize novels sell 5,000 copies. How does a writer, in fact, live? How are you doing it?
Well, I think a writer needs a sinecure. And I think things are really bad right now in publishing. And I think we're in the middle of a sea change with social media and electronic books. And there's a big shift going away. And I think transforming publishing. And I think in some ways it could be hopeful. But how does a writer support herself? I teach. I think most writers teach in one form or another or have some other job. My father, for example, had the sinecure of the New Yorker. He also teaches at Princeton. I think that's an age-old problem. It's very rare that you hit the literary jackpot. But I also think this story has been around for a long time. I recently read George Gissing's book, New Grub Street, and that's over 100 years old, set in 1870, I believe. And it was so familiar to me that it made me laugh a lot because of that.
You must have felt so mischievous, Martha, to sit down to a novel called Dear Money as if it were a letter to a lover, and really it is, and know that in the book, the heroine is turning her back on your and your friends and your family's values. What did that feel like as a writer?
It felt like a lot of fun. It really was fun because, at first I got to imagine something completely different, learn about something completely different. I've never done that with writing. It happened that I became interested in 2004 when it was, you know, just an abstract idea, mortgage-backed securities. Nobody was paying attention. But to me, I found a lot of great metaphor there. This was the American dream that was being pooled and packaged and shipped off. And I knew I was approaching it as a novelist. I knew that I wasn't turning my back. I was just having fun with some characters.
The trick about this book is you tell the truth, it seems, about this character. This is a woman somehow or another who is known from the very beginning, from an early grade school composition, that what a writer can do is lie. And she lies to her husband, and while she misses them, she enjoys not having to take charge of getting her kids to their lessons and their sports and their schools, and not having to think about whether it's a good idea for them to learn Hindi. And her husband praises her by saying that she is an observer, but what the reader comes to know about her is that she has hidden, what, a kind of lack of feeling, a moral iceberg behind the crazed observing tendency of the note-taking writer.
Well, her husband thinks that this is just an experiment, that she's just going off to figure something out.
That it's going to be like Warhol, that she's going to study money.
Exactly. And at the end of the novel, it's definitely one of the balls I'm tossing up in the air. Is this a novel within a novel? Is this the novel she's written after Wall Street crumbles? It ends in 2007 with her perched on the top of several big mortgages, and banks are beginning to think about starting to crumble. What's going to happen to her? So it's definitely something I'm playing with. Was this just an excursion into this crazy, foolish time of ours?
And we sit with her almost by her side, the way her mentor does. Her mentor, by the way, is named Wynn. Wynn Johns. And his little sister couldn't pronounce Wayne, but it's a good name for a trader, and so he keeps it. And he learns to swagger. He has a great swagger. The others do, too. And we sit with him watching India as she loses her first $1 million. And she discovers that it wasn't very much, that there's a lot more to lose in order to be an impressive trader. And she's told to go home and wear her shame proudly.
I mean, this stuff was so fun for me to think about and learn. I mean, I had to get this information from somebody. You know, so these were stories I was hearing and picking up on, and I thought they made for good, you know, good narrative, good insight into this world that was actually expanding before us, before it blew up.
Now, was this your form of retaliation?
Against who? Which party?
Both publishing and the world that made this kind of acquisition so tempting, so easy, and so absolutely unacquirable by a poor, struggling writer.
I don't see myself as a retaliator. I'm too nice. but yes, I mean, in a way, it was what I was observing, and it was frustrating. It was very frustrating to be at the epicenter of wealth and have it all around and have people's concerns about or interest in, you know, my career to be all about book numbers, whether it's, you know, my publisher or my friends, you know, the parents of my children's friends or whoever it is. And I mean, all wonderful people. I'm not indicting anybody. It's just what the culture created. And I wanted to look at that. I wanted to look very closely at it.
Your books, unlike India's, India has hopped with each book to a new publisher. Each of the publishers have told her, we can get attention for this book. The traditional line that comes from publishers, you've stayed with the same publisher, but that publisher has merged with another company.
Mm-hmm.
Harkett Brace, one of the great houses, has merged with Houghton Mifflin, another of the great houses. Now, the book comes in to the house. Were they singing and dancing? Because this has the chance of being a really popular and funny book.
Singing and dancing? No, but I had an editor who I work really closely with, and she was a huge champion from the very beginning and read chapters as they came out of the computer, and was very eager for me to keep going, to finish it, and saw me through the darkest moments, and was incredibly helpful and a huge champion at the house.
Now, this is a funny question because it should be obvious, but no one really ever asks it or says it. What are the dark moments?
Oh, it was hard. You know, first of all, the first half could be seen as being me, my story. It's not. I mean, sure, it's like it's a combination of a lot of different parts of me and parts of other people. The second half, I knew nothing about. I can hardly add. You know, I can hardly balance my checkbook. And I had to take on mortgage-backed securities, which were all about math. And those were some dark days.
Martha, tell me a secret, though. I read on the back cover that you're married to a poet.
Oh, goodness. Now, God help me. I should have become a bond trader. If only.
Is it possible to be married to a poet and be a novelist and raise children? I mean, can it? I mean.
I'm very clever.
Would you do it again?
Marry a poet? No, I'd marry a bond trader. But he'd have to be my husband.
I've been talking with Martha McPhee, author most recently of Dear Money, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you, Martha, for joining me.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Dear Money at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.